walk through the garden.
When you walk through the garden,
you gotta watch your back.
You gotta watch your back.
Well, I beg your pardon.
Welcome to the On the Wire podcast. My guest today is Wade Williamson from Vector Networks, who is the Director of Threat Intelligence. And Wade, it's probably been a year or two since you and I talked. I think we were both at different places the last time we actually had one of these conversations.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I'm now at Vector Networks. So we are, certainly, spending a lot of time taking a look at, what's going on the inside of networks, looking for attackers, kind of, digging deeper into the network, looking for assets. So it's been a really, interesting shift for me.
Yeah. That to me is a really interesting part of it. Cause a lot of, God help me, the threat hunting stuff that you hear about these days in threat intelligence, a lot of it, at least that I see, tends to focus on the endpoints and stuff like that, which is certainly necessary. But to me, a lot of the interesting stuff is going to be gleaned from like network-wide analysis and looking at that stuff in a broader context.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. And I'm never one to kind of throw either of those approaches over. Both are going to be really, really important. But one of the things I always try to kind of remind people is, especially once we're talking about attacks that are active or making the assumption that, a bad guy's going to get in, then what, right? The network is the place that kind of remains trusted. I think Endpoint does some really good stuff, but the thing I always try to remind people is that, once an attacker is on a box, you're kind of, I think of it as being kind of, trapped at sea with the criminal, right? You're on a dinghy, and one of you is going to win that fight, right? And at some point, the good guy or the bad guy wins that fight on the endpoint, but if the bad guy wins, it's hard to trust that view. And the thing that I always kind of like about the network in that respect is you kind of get to sit above it and kind of remain and retain a little bit of that impartial visibility about what's going on, so that if someone does win that first battle, you still have a good vantage point to see what's going on.
Right. Okay, so one of these kind of network topics that interests me right now is ransomware. And, that's another thing that traditionally people have thought about from an endpoint perspective, and rightly so, because most of the ransomware attacks that we've seen up until very recently have been specifically targeted at, consumers or individual users, on a case-by-case basis. They visit a shady website, they click on a infected attachment in a phishing email, and they get infected, and, they either pay or they don't pay, and, life goes on. But we've seen some attacks in the last few months on enterprises, and some pretty, damaging and expensive attacks at that. I know there was that hospital out in California that paid like $20,000 ransom, and then a university up in University of Calgary, I believe, that paid about $20,000 Canadian.
Right.
So, yeah, this is getting to be an expensive thing for organizations as well. So. And I know you guys just released kind of a threat detect or a ransomware detection tool for networks. So tell me about the network approach to this problem.
Yeah. And this kind of dovetails with what we were just talking about, because you're absolutely right. I mean, when you think about ransomware from the past couple of years, ransomware gets on the laptop, it encrypts the data on that laptop and demands a ransom. So pretty clean and simple. But if you're going to demand a ransom from an enterprise and, something around 20K at that, you have to get data that matters. You're going to have to disrupt operations. And that doesn't happen on a single laptop, right? I mean, that is by definition going to go across the network. And the thing I think is kind of interesting there is you're starting to see ransomware follow that same, hate to use the term APT or targeted attack process, but that same kill chain of, all right, I get on one host, but what else can I find in the environment, right? How do I spread out and find the data that actually matters? Because if I'm going to demand a lot of money, I'm going to have to find the file shares. I'm going to have to find data that's actually really important. So you see these attacks kind of slowing down. They're going through that process of doing internal reconnaissance, moving laterally, getting deeper into the network. And in some cases, there's even families of ransomware now that are looking for various types of backup on the network so that they can destroy backup before they even start encrypting.
Oh.
Right? So it's that notion already of, you know, backup and recovery is everyone's kind of best answer at the enterprise level a lot of times for how do I deal with ransomware? I mean, you certainly do want to have good backup, but when the attackers are already kind of starting to think, well, gee, where are those backups? Because I want to trash that stuff before I demand any payment. That's a pretty big jump up in sophistication. So, one of the things that we're doing is, you know, in addition to looking at all of that kind of lateral movement and reconnaissance and all the things that go into a normal attack, we also have data science models that understand kind of what the behavior of ransomware looks like on the network. And it's pretty obvious when you see it on the network, because you start seeing really kind of abnormal read and write behavior over, you know, things like SMB and talking to file shares and things that just really start to stand out. And we can find that typically really, really quickly. And then, you know, we found this in customer environments multiple times, where we not only want to be able to detect that actual ransomware behavior itself, but all the things that led up to it. They're going to have command and control like normal malware will. They're going to do that reconnaissance and lateral movement. So it gets really helpful to be able to come back and say, okay, here are the signs that someone is poking around your data before they start to encrypt things. And of course, once they get into that encryption phase, we can see that behavior too, and be able to kind of sound the alarm. So it's all about seeing those things early and getting that detection really, really quickly, and get action on the detection.
Yeah, that's a good approach, because I know there's some ransomware detection tools out there that, you know, look for generic kind of behaviors that you associate with ransomware, like untrusted processes that are really quickly encrypting files and that sort of thing. But you know, that's
right.
That's useful on the endpoint, but you know, from a network perspective, you know, that's one thing, but you kind of have to have some different approaches as well, right?
Yeah, definitely. And it's back to that idea that, the damage is being done essentially at this point across, more often than not across SMB. So it's something that you're probably, you know, the place where the encryption is happening, or at least where you start to see the files being encrypted, there's not even a process to watch there. You're essentially seeing a protocol across the network. So, you know, by extension, those are the types of things that you're going to need to look for, especially as you start thinking about, well, where do I have important data? How are they going to get to it? And, how do I recognize when I'm starting to lose data on a share that, you know, I may not have an OS running on in a traditional sense?
Is there a reason why they tend to use SMB? Is it just because it's so ubiquitous?
Yeah. It's just the way to kind of get around the network, right? So, So it's just taking advantage of the plumbing of the internal network.
So that the bit you were talking about before with them trashing backups before, even bothering to encrypt the files themselves, that makes a pretty strong case for, you know, the offline backup model, doesn't it?
It does. Two things I think that are important there is that, you know, you can do offline backup or kind of a cold backup, so to speak.
Yeah.
But even that kind of gets you into this little bit of a trade-off, where cold backup tends to be, you know, a little bit further out of sync, because it's not connected all the time, right? So then you may have a little bit more of a gap that you need to consider in terms of, is it okay to not have the absolute latest files and just recover there? And how much pain goes into actually doing, you know, some of the recovery. Folks I've, you know, talked to out in the wild have often, you know, a lot of times their decision to pay or not isn't even around can they recover, but can they get back up and running faster by just doing the decryption as opposed to doing a restore if the restore process is too painful. So those are the things that, you know, guys that kind of get in that bind end up having to kind of weigh the operational cost of, you know, how long is this going to take? You know, what I do think it's a really good argument for using cloud connected backups and things that are, you know, harder to encrypt as opposed to just kind of like a SMB connected file share.
Right. I mean, I completely understand that line of thinking, especially from an enterprise perspective. I know that's one of the things that hospital in California, in LA, said in the statement after they paid the ransom was basically like, this was our quickest path to getting the network restored. You know, they didn't mention whether they had good backups, but they just said, this is the fastest route to getting back up and running and, you know, making sure our patients are safe.
Right. Right.
Which is
good. Yeah. That seemed to be,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. That seemed to be some of the logic on the University of Calgary side too, is in, you know, I don't know that they, their backup was good or not, but that, you know, they were in the position that they had, you know, research going on at the university. They had, important data, and it was more of a, you know, this, you know, we just can't negotiate with this data. We just need to have it back and have it back now. So it was more of a, you know, the network was down for several days, and it just came to a point that, you know, we've got to get back up and running. So,
yeah, that is not a position that I envy, you know, especially in a large network like that. Is, you know, a university setting where they all, you know, and those are tough, especially because they're meant to be open networks. And you know, the staff and the students all rely on the email. And I know that was one of the main services that went down there. So, you know, I would imagine there were some pretty heated discussions about like, we need to pay this ransom now, or, you know, or here's what's going to happen. So those cannot be fun conversations to have.
Yeah, absolutely. And on a regular basis, I have, you know, incredible amounts of empathy for the folks who have to tackle security in university environments, because, you know, they're just really, really challenging environments to deliver security in, because, you know, you do have extremely permissive use policies, which, you know, in a higher ed environment, that's probably a good thing. And you want to have people have independence and privacy, so they're not, you know, cracking open SSL in most cases and doing all that type of good stuff. So you, and you know, they're the mother of all BYOD environments, right?
Yeah.
Pretty much every device that comes on that, into those environments was, you know, brought from the outside. So, you know, if there's a security problem to be had, universities tend to have it in really large quantities. So, I definitely feel for the guys over on the Calgary side. But again, it's one of those things that, I think that is one of the places where we go back and kind of dig in and like working with those environments, because those are also the places where you know that there's going to be that first level of incursion from bad guys. And that's one of the things that we've started to do, is that we can look at all of the all the customers that share data with us and look at, well, which environments are getting the most types of threats. And not surprisingly, you know, university environments kind of lead the pack in terms of the number of threats that they get per host, right? So essentially, yeah, you know, I'm trying to normalize for the size of those guys. But being able to at least kind of get an understanding for, okay, we do see malware behavior, we're starting to see command and control, but being able to really start to sound the alarm if you start to see things moving deeper into networks, starting to see lateral movement, especially starting to see people access data. Those environments, it's really important to be able to say, well, let's kind of turn the lens around a little bit and say, let's focus on the stuff we're trying to protect as opposed to keeping every germ in the world outside of our environment, because that's one of those things that they're going to have a really hard time to do, but they can protect their data.
Yep. I think that's a good approach. So on the threat intelligence side, when you talk to customers and they're, you know, interested in threat intelligence, what are they talking about specifically? I mean, I feel like I've seen 700 different definitions and, you know, use cases and everything else for threat intel, and everybody's got a different idea of what it is. So, you know, what are your customers looking at specifically when they talk about that?
Well, I mean, it's a little bit of a challenge, frankly, because there's lots and lots of intelligence feeds out there, and you get into this situation where intelligence feeds certainly are, you know, a good thing. Sharing information sounds like a good thing. Having more intelligence is always a good thing. But the way that you're going to have to operationalize an intelligence feed, and the whole, you know, value of an intelligence feed, is that hopefully you're going to be getting a really important answer that you need in a timely fashion, you know, right before you get hit by a threat. So, you know, you want to get more information faster, and you want to get that information delivered into your security product. So if I want, you know, signatures, I want to get them into my IPS or my gateway or something that's going to do enforcement for me. And I think that the trick there is that the thing that cuts both ways is that if you're going to be able to take that data and really quickly put it into something that's going to do enforcement, it's got to be a pretty straightforward set of information. And that typically boils down to, you know, the traditional things that you expect in terms of, well, here's a new malware hash I've seen. Here's a new IP address that I've seen that's been acting bad. Here's a new domain that's been acting bad, right? Because pretty much any system can ingest that type of information and put it in.
Mm-hmm.
And the issue there is that, you know, those are valuable, especially for the commodity threats, but you're still always behind the leading attacker who's going to use something custom, who's not going to use an IP that's on a blacklist or any of those things, right? So it's a good way of kind of keeping pace with botnets and things that operate at a large scale.
Yeah.
But it's still always kind of putting you a little bit behind the guys that are smart enough not to use things that are known to be bad. So then you start to see a little bit of shift in the intelligence landscape for things kind of that are more, I almost think of them as kind of the subscription for someone's kind of proprietary system. So, you know, if you have a very proprietary system that has more intelligence than, you know, just using a signature of a hash or something like that, then it's specialized enough that your intelligence feed's probably going to come from the same guy who built that system, right? It's hard to get a network effect for something that's really kind of customized and specialized. So that's a long way of saying that I think that there's a lot of promise in intelligence feeds, but when you get into, you know, how they get used and kind of operationalized on a daily basis, there's this kind of bind of, you know, if I'm going to benefit from large extended networks, then the information that they provide me gets kind of more, not necessarily genericized, but it's got to be easily generically consumable. And then you kind of just get into the, I'm getting signatures a little bit faster, which still has kind of some challenges. So with all of that said, and sorry for that background, but, you know, one of the things I think is important is to start understanding what are the fundamental things that you can see in an attack that lead the attacker. And what I mean by lead the attacker is, even as they're changing IP addresses and changing domains and recrypting their malware, what are the things that those threats do that stay the same, right? So yeah. If you're starting to look for fundamental behaviors and starting to look for fundamental tactics and things like that, then you're not always in this race against the clock of, well, a new IP was just seen in this attack and now I need to update all my gear. Your detections in that sense should be lasting for weeks and months, because if you're doing it right, you're zeroing in on some pretty fundamental behavior. So that's really the trick, is that trying to make sure that if you're thinking about intelligence, think about it in a way that allows you to actually get ahead of the attacker, as opposed to a little bit less behind. And more often than not, I think it ends up being that ladder of, you know, a lot of people spend a lot of money on feeds to get a little bit less behind.
Yeah, that's kind of my impression too. And I also feel like there's so many variables involved in all of this. You know, the type of network that you're on, you know, the team that's using the threat intelligence feeds, you know, what they're responsible for, all those kind of things. I mean, how much do those variables play into the kind of intelligence organizations are looking for and how they use it?
That's a really good point. You know, the type of network is gonna matter. Also, just the what sorts of things are you looking to block, and what is the tolerance for any type of problem from that feed, right? I mean, the danger as information and signatures and feeds have gotten faster and faster is, well, how well do you tolerate false positives, right? Mm-hmm. Because if you're going to be on the bleeding edge of kind of signature creation, that's always the thing that you have to kind of keep in mind. And if you're in a really secure environment where people are able to tolerate, well, we're going to lean forward on security. We're in a financial environment. If someone can't access a, you know, travel site, just as an example, right, then that's something we're going to live with, and it's part of being able to accept and operationalize a really kind of bleeding edge intelligence feed, versus if you go back to, you know, our example earlier of the universities, people are going to scream bloody murder if you start blocking things that turn out to not be bad, right?
Yep.
So I think the type of network you're in, the type of data that you're protecting, definitely plays into the tolerance for how tight you're going to actually enforce those things. And a lot of times I think what we're starting to see sometimes is new rules go in and not necessarily being used for blocking, right? You're still going to alert on them and use that as kind of correlation information to say, well, if I see that I'm starting to trigger some of my new early deployed rules, and maybe they start to score a host in those sense, in that sense, or say, well, I've got a couple of things that have triggered here that let me know that something's maybe off with a particular laptop in my environment. Maybe I need to go investigate it. And they're using the intelligence feeds to kind of have that additional correlating view into what's going on, as opposed to trying to use it on a kind of frontline prevention basis.
Yeah. Okay, so I know you're at the Gartner Security Summit this week in D.C., and I would imagine that the threat intelligence topic is probably one of the overarching themes there, at least in some of the tracks. What else are you seeing there that's been interesting or somewhat enlightening?
Yeah, I'm starting to see more interest in being able to kind of be resilient as a network. And this is a thing that's, you know, certainly been kind of evolving over not just at the conference, but actually over the, you know, past several months to over a year. And the thing that I think is getting really interesting is there's a ton of interest in analytics on the network, and there's a lot of debate around, not even debate, but kind of discussion about, you know, what are the best ways to do that, right? How do you ingest information, both from threat feeds, but also based on the stuff that you're seeing in your own network, where, you know, the other side of the coin around threat feeds is that there's a ton of things that have to do with how attackers get in and steal your data that have nothing to do with anything you would ever hear from a threat feed, right? In the sense that if someone's compromised and or maybe even they're an insider and they start behaving strangely in my network, mm-hmm. no threat feed's ever going to tell you that. You're going to have to get those analytics yourself in your environment, right? And it's that combination of, well, you know, do I go out and kind of look at access logs and try to map out user behavior and get good understanding that way? Can I look at the network itself and get a good understanding of what's going on in the network? And what I think is starting to be kind of interesting, to me at least, is there's the opportunity to kind of blend those two approaches where, if you think about threat feeds, you know, what threat feeds are trying to do is identify things that are kind of known attacker behavior. And, you know, tools, command and control, whatever, you know, types of techniques that they're using to do bad things, you want to be able to identify those things.
Right.
And on the kind of behavioral analysis side, especially the user side, you're kind of looking for, all right, well, what's anomalous in my environment? You know, what's strange that I didn't expect to see or kind of looked out of place? And I think you get really powerful when you can combine those two approaches, right, into kind of a unified view to say, well, here's actual attacker behavior I was seeing. Here's a sign of a custom rat that nobody's ever seen before, but it's also being aligned and correlated with some really strange user behavior on the inside of the network, right? And that turns into something that, you know, each by themselves could have been, you know, that's not good. I need to go investigate that. But if I see those two things together, then I know I have something that I can take action on. And I think kind of bringing those two almost kind of left and right brain versions of kind of security intelligence together is something that I see people at the conference starting to kind of wrap their head around and start figuring out how to implement those sorts of things.
Yeah, again, that's a tough job that I don't necessarily envy anybody that has to do that kind of analytic work, because there's just so much information and analysis that goes on these days. I'm not sure how, you know, any one person or any one team in an organization is able to keep up with it. You know, I feel like you just kind of get
completely agree.
You get overwhelmed at some point, you know, you're just like, okay, here's all this stuff coming from my network. Here's all this stuff that, you know, other people outside of the organization are telling us about, like, what the hell matters? Like, I don't know how you figure that out.
Yeah. And frankly, I mean, you're absolutely right there. I mean, that is the place where automation and what I think of as, and it's not really AI, but where like the kind of machine learning side of the world can really, it really has to solve that problem, because we're getting to a point already where there's so much information, so much metadata coming from various places that this is, it's becoming an untractable problem for a human to solve, mm-hmm. right? Even if you just had a team of guys looking at screens all day long, you're talking about enormous amounts of data of different types, right? You're talking about attacker behavior. You're talking about user anomalies. Each one of those things is going to require some pretty good data science skills and some pretty good security skills. And that just doesn't scale as a human analyst. No. So I think that the really kind of cool stuff that's going to be emerging over the next few years is, you know, how do we automate that job of kind of analyzing and synthesizing all of this information into an answer that you can then give to an analyst to say, here are the answers. Here's what you need to go do, but at least automate that process of finding the right needles in the right haystacks.
Yeah, there's a serious lack of definitive answers in all of this. You know, there's, I think people tend to forget that there's still a lot of, you know, guesswork, usually highly educated guesswork, but, you know, guesswork that goes on in terms of like knowing how to respond and what's an actual threat a lot of times.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's one of those things that I think that it's kind of on us and some of the in the security industry to do a better job of around. We like as security vendors to come back and say, well, we applied a whole bunch of smarts to this problem and we found this maybe problem. Aren't we good for finding this anomaly? You know, give us a cookie. And right. That does not help an analyst or anybody who's actually on the front lines of doing something is, all right, great. Now I have another anomaly to throw on the pile. What do I do with that? Mm-hmm. Right. So I think kind of getting to the point where we can give some really high confidence answers and say, here's, you know, based on everything that we're seeing, here are the one, two, or three hosts that we think are at the center of an attack and what you should do with them. That is something that I think is, you don't see as much of out there. And that's where I think a lot of the kind of real value is going to have to be going forward.
Yep, I agree. All right, Wade. Well, listen, man, thanks so much for your time. I know you're in the middle of the conference there, so I appreciate you ducking out and making some time for me. It was good to catch up, and thanks for all the insight, man. It was a great conversation.
Great. Thanks for the time, and hope to do it again.
Definitely. All right, take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
When you walk through the garden,
when you walk through the garden,
you gotta watch your back.